his wife, and he was very abusive, not just emotionally but physically as well. And she was a really tiny lady, and so he and I met one morning, just the two of us, and about 8 o'clock in the morning. He sits down across from me, and we talk for a while. And I had known him for a while. He didn't go to our church or anything else; just knew him from baseball and stuff. And he said he starts getting, you know, just kind of belligerent. And I said, you know, I think I know what the problem is. He said, "What's the problem?" I said, "Well, you have an anger problem." And he got angry, like really, really angry. In fact, he got up from across my desk and he stood over my desk, just bowed up, just like, you know, trying to intimidate me. And I said, you know, you might as well sit down because I'm not scared of you. So I'm not your wife. I'm not worried about you. And he looked at me just seething, veins popping out of his neck. And I said, and you know as well as I do that I can take you if I have to. And he looked. And I'm praying, Lord, I don't want to fight somebody at 8 o'clock in the morning, biblical counseling in my office. He starts laughing, sat down, and I'm like, thank you, Jesus, I didn't have to fight anybody this morning. Imagine the testimony there. So we are on the roles of husbands and wives in these first two sessions this morning. maybe the most difficult to hear. And it may also be the most controversial to teach. And so for those who aren't married, you think, well, I'm skating free on this one. You're not, actually. This is what you should consider in somebody who would be your future spouse. And this is also what you should be in order to be qualified to have a spouse. And you say, well, how do I know, right? And well, men, how you treat your mom and your sisters, how you treat the women in your life is ultimately how you'll treat your wife. And women, how you honor authority will ultimately be how you honor your husband. And so you can see a lot before somebody's married and how they'll be once they're married. So I did not grow up in a home where I saw my dad pray. My earliest memory of my dad was sitting at the table in North Carolina when I was in probably first or second grade, and after dinner, it was my job to give my dad his dessert, and his dessert were cigarettes. We didn't go to church together. We didn't pray together. We didn't read the Bible together. So when I'm teaching on what it looks like to be a godly husband, you got to understand that I am not doing it from the perspective of a second-generation Christian or a third-generation Christian. I came to Christ at 26 years old. And so I've never seen it growing up. And our culture now has such a skewed view of men. Men are portrayed as buffoons in commercials and on television shows. And with the growing number of single moms and absent fathers and worldly parenting, we have this growing refusal of young men to grow up and take responsibility. I like how Paul put it in 1 Corinthians 16. He says, be on the alert. I don't know if that's in your notes, but he says, be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, and act like men, be strong. Boy, that's such a good verse, isn't it? Because our world is redefining manhood, and the way they're redefining manhood and leadership and responsibility is that men play. And they get in touch with their feminine side. And yet Paul says, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong. And so I meet grown men every month. They come in and out of my office, and they have no idea of what the tremendous responsibility is that they have to act like men, to simply be strong. Look what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13. He says, when I was a child, I used to speak like a child, think like a child, reason like a child. When I became a man, I did away with childish things. And you know as well as I do that our society and our churches are lacking men who will put away childish things. And so what does it mean to be a man? You know, I'm a sports fan. I think I put that out last night. Disappointed nobody else was a Lightning fan. We won, by the way, 7-1 last night, if anybody is interested. But men are really good at putting everything they have into rooting for their teams or building a business, but when it comes to lead, so often we just defer to our wives and we just tell our children to ask your mother. And so before we start, man to man, I just want to say we need this talk probably more than we want to hear this talk. And for the ladies, the tendency that you have is to get your elbows warmed up and to start jabbing your husband and going, did you hear what he just said? Right? Don't do that. Instead, pray for your husband. Don't circle things in your little handbook and go, did you see that? Right? Don't circle and star and then, oh, did I leave that in the bathroom? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know that was in there. But take this time. Listen well. Pray well for your husband. Consider how difficult it must be to be a man of God, considering the home that he was raised in and the culture that he's living in. Considering the weight of responsibility that God has put on men. And the biblical model for being a man of God is so radical and it's so impossible that unless God shows up in an amazing way, what happens with men is we live under a cloud of guilt. And what happens when we have guilt is that we change for about a week, sometimes 2 weeks, right? Remember that success and or failure, survival and success diagram? So we do really well at getting our heads above water, right? But then we just kind of plateau out and eventually die out. And that's what happens when we're motivated by guilt. I love what Vodi Bakum said. He says, we may not do this perfectly, but our prayer should be better today than yesterday, better tomorrow than today. Boy, if we could do that, right? Just better today than yesterday, better tomorrow than today. And so Ephesians talks about the role of the wife first, but I think it's best to talk about the role of the husband first. And, you know, for probably 5 years ago, I would say I never, ever had a couple come in for counseling where the husband was interested in spiritual things and turning his family into a spiritual family, a godly family, and the wife wasn't. Like zero. First 5 years I was a counselor, zero instances where that happened. Now I think we've probably got five. It's becoming more common where the man is coming in for counseling. He's dragging his wife in, and she's not interested. It's a dilemma that's getting ready to start. And so, you know, there was a survey done, I think it was in Sweden or Switzerland, one of the two. And they were trying to say, well, how do we change the church culture? How do we impact our society among churches? And the belief was, well, we have to do VBS and children's ministries, have these great nursery programs and all these things. And what they found is that if a child comes to faith in Christ first, there's about, and I don't have the exact statistics, but we're pretty close, there's about a 7% chance that the rest of the family will follow. So if the child prays that sinner's prayer, gets baptized or whatever, there's about a 7% chance that the rest of the family will be in church. If a teenager is the first, then it jumps up to about 14 to 16% chance. If the wife is the first one to come to faith, it jumps up significantly to around 40% will come to faith in Christ as the whole family. But if the husband does, 96% chance that the rest of the family will follow. Can you see the importance that we place on the role of the husband in the home? And yet, what are our churches doing? They're pushing vacation Bible school. I'm all for vacation Bible school, okay? But we put so much time and energy and emotion and investment into children, which is great for the children. But if we're going to impact our culture, if we're going to impact our society, if Ocala is going to be changed, it's going to be because we have reached the men in our community. And when men lead, it is a beautiful thing. And the question becomes, how do we reach men? That's the hard part. Okay, that's the difficult part, is how do we reach men? I mean, just think about your own church. In your church, the vast majority of the churches that we'll go to and visit, is what we see is that there are a lot of women who come to church without their husbands. Very few husbands would come without their wives. We are a very unique church at Community Bible Church. From what I can tell, we only have 1 to 2 women who come to CBC without their husbands. But we have 3 or 4 men who come without their wives. We've been very intentional about reaching men. And most churches have 0 men who will attend that their wives won't come with them. And so if we're going to see lasting change, we reach the husbands. And so let's read our passage. It's going to be from Ephesians 5. We'll only read it once. It's in the wives section as well. But since we're doing this back to back, we'll just read it this one time. Ephesians 5, beginning of verse 22. It says, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own body. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." In context, this is the context of Ephesians. Is Ephesians is written in such a way where Paul begins the book of Ephesians by telling us who we are in Christ. Chapter 4, he starts with the word therefore. In other words, because of who we are in Christ, therefore, this is how you should behave, right? So in 1 to 3, he says, you're redeemed, you're reconciled, you're sealed with the Spirit, you're forgiven, you're given all the mysteries of old are all made known to you. Therefore, this is how you should behave. And then he goes into talking about what it looks like to be filled with the Spirit. He says, don't get drunk with wine, for that's dissipation. Don't be controlled with alcohol, right? But instead, be controlled by the Spirit. Well, what does it look like to be controlled by the Spirit? Well, you sing. It's first in your mouth. You speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. And so the first place that we can recognize if somebody's filled with the Spirit is in our tongues, what we say. We'll deal with that more in session 5. But the context goes further than that. Not just in what we say, but in our homes. How do you know if somebody is filled with the Spirit? Well, wives will submit and respect their husbands. Husbands will love and nourish and nurture and cherish his wife. Well, how do we know if kids are filled with the Spirit? Because they'll honor their father and mother. How do we know that parents are filled with the Spirit? Because they won't provoke their children to anger, but they'll bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. You see how it... So contextually, this is a Spirit-filled issue. Are you Spirit-filled? Well, we know basically based on how we treat one another. And so it is a biblical requirement of the husband to be the spiritual leader in the family. And I say that without apology. It is the biblical requirement for the husband to be the spiritual leader of their homes. Okay, and it's not because I'm bigger and stronger and meaner, right? It's my responsibility as a husband is to lovingly lead my home like Christ lovingly leads his church. And just because God has called me to be the spiritual leader in the home, it doesn't mean that I'm more valuable than my wife or my kids. The challenge in our day is nobody wants to lead. And so today, my hope is to show you what it looks like to lead a home. And as we work through this, I want to first emphasize poor leadership, okay? We'll emphasize the negative in order before we get to the positive. And so let's look at some common failures in biblical leadership. In 1 Peter 3, Peter says, "You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered." Now, weaker does not mean less than. Okay, generally speaking, if you line up the men on this side of the church and you lined up the women on this side of the church, and you said, okay, let's just fight to the finish. Who's going to win? The men are. Okay? Generally speaking, we are stronger. Okay? So weaker does not mean less than. And that term, and I love the term, understanding way, it's speaking of living with knowledge. And so as men, like our role, our job is to go back to school. It's wife 101. It's our job to be students of our wives. And what's a crazy thing is in this 1 Peter 3 passage is you have to realize that if you're not in fellowship with your wife, your prayers are hindered. If I mistreat my wife, my relationship with God is severely affected by that. And you know, we're great students of favorite sports teams or new tools or the stock market or our business, but our greatest study as men is to study our wives. So let's put the men on the spot for just a second. Men, lean over to your wife and tell her what her favorite restaurant is. Did he get it right? Yeah, we got a couple yeses. How about favorite perfume? Anything you wear, baby, you know that. What comforts her? I do, right? I do. That's it. What encourages her? All right, and so I'll ask the men this question. You don't have to lean over to your wife. You can just nod to me, or you can just shake your head and say no. And the question is, do you know when your wife wants you to fix a problem and when she just wants you to listen? Me either. I have to ask sometimes, did you want me to fix this or you just want me to listen? And she says, I just want you to listen. And I think, but I could fix it. I could completely fix this. She don't want me to fix it. She just wants me to listen. So I bite a hole in my lip and don't say anything. And it's the craziest thing. We were joking with the couple we were counseling the other day, how different men and women are. You know, you go to a restaurant. I was actually with Yuli Brookins the other day. We were having lunch together, Pastor at the Vine. And there were two women sitting next to us. And they were talking. You could tell it was kind of a deep conversation and stuff like that, and a lot of emotion in it. And they were leaned across the table holding hands, and just you could just see them just weeping with one another and talking. And man, what a great conversation it is. Well, Yuli and I were talking about some really difficult stuff, and I thought I would never reach across the table and grab his hands and hold his hands and look into his eyes and say, "I feel so bad for you." Right? Like, we're so different, and yet that's what our wives want. No, just shut up and listen. Like, just hold my hand, look in my eyes, and listen. Okay, I'm not very good at that yet, but I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm just not very good at that. And so we are supposed to be learning leaders. And what we tend to do as men is we tend to err on one side or the other. And so on one side, we're the arrogant dictator. Okay, when we talk about leadership, we become the arrogant dictator. And so the arrogant dictator, he believes that he thinks he can do that whatever he wants. Okay, I'm the leader, my way or the highway, me man, you woman, me say, you do, right? That's not the picture of biblical leadership. The philosophy of the arrogant dictator is whatever I want, I get. And what I can tell you this is men want respect. The arrogant dictator wants respect, but if he doesn't get it, remember we said yesterday, he'll settle for fear. If he doesn't get the respect, then he'll settle for fear. He would rather have his wife afraid of him than to somehow think that he's not being respected. I had a couple I was counseling, and this arrogant dictator husband kind of jokingly looked over the table and he said, "Hey, get to the submit and respect part." Man, I wanted to go jump across that table and throttle him. An arrogant dictator thinks way too highly of himself than he ought to think. And if that's you, if you tend to err on the side of being the arrogant dictator, then you need to start valuing and inviting your wife's perspective. Listen, it's good that she's not like you. You don't want to be married to you. Arrogant people are convinced that they know it all, they should have it all, and can do things better than anybody else. So some guys fall on the side of arrogant dictator. Some guys fall on the side of the passive pleaser. I think the Christian church has really encouraged men to be passive pleasers. And we've done it using biblical terms like love your wife unconditionally. That means give her everything she wants. Or they pull the servant leadership card and say, well, Jesus washed his disciples' feet, so you should do whatever service your wife wants you to do. Listen, that's not loving your wife. That's loving yourself. Right? That's giving in to her, giving her whatever she wants, so that you don't have to put up with her wrath of not getting what she wants. So the philosophy of the passive pleaser is, well, it's not whatever I want. The passive pleaser, the philosophy is, yes, dear, whatever you say. So which side do you err on? Wives, no, don't tell your husbands. Which side do you err on? Whatever I want or whatever you say? So do you tend to err on the side of the arrogant dictator or the passive pleaser? Well, let's look at the proper picture of biblical leadership. And we saw that from verse 25, right? Husbands, love your wives just like Christ loved the church. And so the first word there, husband's love, we talked about it last night. It's agape. It's unconditional love. Husbands, unconditionally love your wife. And the world has so cheapened the idea of love. The fact that it's unconditional means that it's not dependent on my wife's attitude, and it's not dependent on my wife's behavior, and it's not dependent on how much she respects me or doesn't respect me. I mean, if you just think about it, Jesus loved you when you weren't worthy to be loved. Doesn't Romans 5 say that? God demonstrates, or God proves his own love toward us, and that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. Not when we were good that he gave us his best. When we were at our worst, he gave us his best. Husbands, love your wives that way. Agape love is not a feeling. It's not an emotion. And it's not dependent on how much she respects you. Nor is it dependent on how much she submits to you or obeys you or even likes you. Unconditional love is a love that we have. It's a commitment that seeks after the good of my wife that's not dependent on her. So that's the first thing. If you go, well, how do I lead, right? How do I lead? Well, number one, you lead in unconditional love. Number two is you lead in sacrificial love. Loving sacrificially means that it has to cost me something to love my wife. If it doesn't cost, then it's not sacrificial. And it could be something simple. It could be just a matter of turning off the TV. It may be putting down your phone. Listen, I don't know about you guys. I can't do two things at one time. If I'm on my phone like this, or if I'm watching TV, I'm really not engaged. I may nod my head. I may acknowledge, but I'm not engaged. Sacrificially, I need to put it down. It may mean that we need to get up early or go for a walk. You see, it's easy to die for our wives once, right? Really difficult to die daily. And you know, there are 168 hours in every week. That's it. Nobody gets any more, nobody gets any less. And yet we talked about it last night. The most common excuse we get for why people won't do something is, I am just so busy. Really, I don't think that's ever really a good excuse, is that we're so busy. I think the better question is, do you always accomplish your priorities? Okay, do you always accomplish your priorities? Now, most of you guys would say yes, In fact, I asked that question in Honduras a couple months ago. I said, do you always accomplish your priorities? And everybody said, no, we don't always accomplish our priorities. And I said, yeah, you do, actually. You always accomplish the things that are most important to you. For instance, our oldest daughter and her kids are at the house right now. And if I got a text message here on my iPad this morning, and she said, hey, Dad, just wanted to see if you wouldn't mind making breakfast for us this morning. Okay, now, do I love my daughter? Of course I love my daughter. Would I be willing to make breakfast for her? Yeah, I would be willing to make breakfast for her. But why won't I make breakfast for her? Because you guys are my priority. But what if she said, texted, hey, Dad, Hannah just fell off the stool. She hit her head and we're rushing her to the emergency room. All of a sudden, you guys aren't that much a priority in my life, are you? I mean, I like you and all, but not that much. See, you always accomplish the things that are most important to you. So rather than saying, you know, I've just been so busy, you can simply say it just hasn't been a priority. You always accomplish your top priorities. Most of us just need to change our priorities. Isn't it amazing that the old cliche, you never have time to do it right the first time, but you always do the second? So prioritizing your family means coming home from work to spend time with your family. And most of the men that I talk to, they say, well, but I have to provide. Like, that's admirable. I love hard work. And I think there are times, though, that men go to the opposite extreme of that, and they just abandon their families because they work too much. Even with my dad's diagnosis, really, this has been a 3-year journey for us. I've had to cancel counseling appointments, speaking engagements, chaplain hours that I do at the Y, all kinds of stuff. Why? Because he's a priority. There are certain things that I have to do. Other things have to be sacrificed for your priority. There are 168 hours every week. That's it. Nobody gets more, nobody gets less. And somebody is going to get cheated because you can't do it all. And here's the person, you know, the person that will understand more than anybody else is your wife and your kids. I know you're so busy. I know you've got such an important job. I know you're trying to provide for our family. And so, remember we talked about yesterday? It's a gradual, right? Gradual thing that happens suddenly. Divorce is just gradual, but then it happens suddenly. It's just this slow leak where we don't prioritize things. And so we have to lead unconditionally. We have to lead sacrificially. Number three, it's purifying love. Ephesians 5, look at verse 26. I'll read it. It says, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So the idea is, since Jesus is committed to making us holy, then the role of the husband is to be committed to make his wife holy. The role of the husband is to love his wife in such a way that she would become more beautiful, right, more mature spiritually. It's to mentor your wife and your children in the scriptures. It's not just about being a Christian. And for those who aren't married, like, imagine the damage you're doing to your children by marrying somebody who can't lead biblically. I mean, you are risking the future generations because he's cute. And men, as we hear that, I mean, we have to consider, what are we doing for the future of our family? You know, for us, it's funny. You know, I got saved, and Sherry had already been a Christian for 13 years. I tricked her into thinking that I was a Christian. And within a week after we were married, she tells me, she said, I thought, oh, no, there is no way this guy's saved. And so every night, you know those daily breads, those devotionals? Every night, she would lay in bed and read that daily bread out loud to me. And then she'd say, what did it say? And I went, something about Jesus or something? No, listen. And then she'd read the whole thing over again for 6 years. Over and over and over again. So for me, and I get saved, and my the guy who's discipling me says, you're the spiritual leader in your home. And I'm like, not me. Sherry's been a Christian for 13 years. She knows the books of the Bible. When we sing, when we used to have to use hymnals and stuff like that, she didn't even have to use a hymnal. She knew the songs. She had memory verses. She knows biblical truth. But he's like, no, that's your responsibility. I would say it took about 18 months before I could take that role of spiritual leader. You know, people used to always say, boy, Mike, you know, kids growing up, your kids growing up, goes by so quickly. It does. 8 children, 3 of them left at home, 5 gone, and the buck stops with me. It's my responsibility. It's my responsibility to protect my daughters spiritually and emotionally and physically. And when they get married, I transfer that responsibility to their husbands. It's my responsibility to teach my son how to protect his wife spiritually and emotionally, physically, so that he can do that for his wife. And you go, so where do we start? You know, this is where I started. My wife was way ahead of me. I was way behind. This is where I started. I would get up on Sunday morning, and I would wake up the kids. I'd make breakfast, and my Filipino background, we would have bacon, eggs, and rice, you know, for breakfast. So I'd make bacon, eggs, and rice for the whole family, and then I'd just, one by one, I'd just go to each of the kids, and I'd say, hey, guess what? We get to go to church today. Not everybody in the world gets to go to church today, but today we get to go to church. Come on, get up, get up, get up. I've already made breakfast. I'd go to the next child, and I'd say, hey, guess what? We get to go to church today. Over and over and over again. And they'd come in, and there was an excitement about, we get to go to church. But you know what happens in most of our homes today, most of our churches. The wife gets all the kids up. The wife gets all the kids ready. The wife makes the breakfast. The wife gets out to the car, and just before she goes out there, she wakes her husband up and says, hey, we got to go. You ready? And he throws on some clothes, mumbling, and he gets in the car, and they go to church together. That's not leading. I mean, just start there. You don't have to know great spiritual truth to start there. You have to know how to cook a little bit. If you wake up earlier, you just go to Dunkin' Donuts or something and get something. But the idea is lead. Just start somewhere. Now, one of the things that I really like here, and Peter Bracknell is actually the one that showed it to me, is in this verse, verse 27, he says, so that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So if Jesus is to present his bride as pure and spotless and blameless, well, what does that mean for me as a husband? It means this: I must never speak negatively about my wife to others, ever. I need to present my wife as a pure and spotless and blameless one, because that's what Jesus does. Does he do it because we are pure and spotless and blameless? Positionally, yes. Practically, no. It drives me nuts to hear a guy calling his wife his old lady or the old ball and chain. I think, man, how disrespectful that is. I heard one internationally known pastor, if I said his name now, most of you recognize him. But he was speaking one day about how bad his wife snores and how tired he was that Sunday morning. I've never listened to him again. And I think, if you're going to throw your wife under the bus like that, to not present her in a good light, I'm going to really want to listen to you. Jesus loves the church so much that he presents her pure. Now, and I would say this, if you're a single lady in here, one thing that you need to know is that if you have a guy who is always trying to take the relationship to the next level because to prove you love me, he really doesn't love you, he loves himself. He's not somebody who will lead in purifying love, because the husband should be the one who sets the standard for righteousness in the home. It's the husband's responsibility. And because it's our responsibility, my cell phone is always available. I don't erase my history. I don't have to turn the TV off when somebody comes in the room. My wife has my passwords to all my texts and all my emails. All of my kids can find me on Find My Friends. If that's not true of you, like, what are you hiding? You're not leading in purifying love. Number four, he must lead in selfless love. He must lead in selfless love. We see that in verse 28. He says, so husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church. Selfless love, we accomplish this by loving our wife like we love ourselves. When we got married, God made us one. And so she's part of you. And Paul assumes that every man already loves himself unconditionally. What do I mean by that? Well, we love ourselves unconditionally. So when we are cold, we warm ourselves. When we're hot, we cool ourselves. When we're hungry, we feed ourselves. When we're thirsty, we don't drink ourselves, but we get a drink. So Jesus never commanded you to love yourself. His command was always to love your neighbor in the same way that you love yourself. And so to lead in selfless love, really there's two words that define this love. The first is nourish. It literally means to provide. And so as husbands, God's call on us is to provide for our wives physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And honestly, if that means that I need to take a second job or a third job to provide, then that's what I do. It also means that a little practical things is I open the door for her. I give her my chair. I carry her suitcase. I clear the path. I help with dishes or whatever else that might look like. And if we're going to lead, then we have to do it. We have to take the initiative to do it. Like, don't wait to be asked. It's not going to hurt to be a gentleman. It'll actually help. I used to tell Adam, I'd say, man, if you just be a gentleman, you don't even have to be good looking. Right, ladies? You just be a gentleman. You don't even have to be good looking. To cherish literally means to keep warm. To keep warm. Well, how do I keep my wife warm? Well, in context, this is done by caring for her. This is done by protecting her, and this is done by providing for her. Godly men treat women like they're precious. Godly men nurture, nourish, cherish, and protect women. Women should feel incredibly valued when they're with godly men. And you know, with all this stuff going on in Hollywood and the Me Too movement, can we all agree that men have failed woefully in this? In this room, as in every room, 25%, 1 in 4 women have been sexually abused. Most of the time from a male family member. That's not being selfless. That's being selfish. So how do we know if a man is going to lead this way? Women? Single women? How do we know if a man is going to lead this way? How does he treat his mom? How does he treat his sisters? How does he treat the women in his life? You know, Sherry and I went to this little marriage seminar. It was in a home. It was probably 10 or 12 weeks. And the first week they asked the question, why did you marry your husband or wife? And I said some really belligerent, ignorant, immature thing. And I don't want to repeat it now, but I thought it was funny then. Nobody else laughed in the room. You know how that goes. And so it became Sherry's turn. Why did you marry your husband? Her answer was, because I saw how much he loved his mom. And I thought, wow, if he loves his mom that much, how much more would he love me? That was before cell phones and everything else. That was back in the day when you had to pay for phone calls. And Sherry was so impressed that I would call my mom at least once a week, write letters to my mom. Man, I love my mom. That was to her the most attractive thing. I know you're thinking, man, but look at you. No, that wasn't it. Go figure. Number five, he must lead in intimate love. Intimate love. And the guy's like, yes, intimate love. Now, intimacy, it happens when you let somebody into a part of your life that's not readily available to everybody else. It's a friendship, it's a closeness that you have. Affairs begin when one spouse says to somebody who's not their spouse, you know, I've never told anybody this before. You see what's happening there is you're letting them into a part of you that's not readily available to anybody else. When I lead an intimacy, it's my job to build into the friendship side of our marriage. We're best friends. There should be no secrets and there should be neither one of us looking to fulfill any relational or emotional needs with somebody else. And the crazy thing is, that's typically easier for women to do, right? But God has called us to do it as men. We are to lead in intimacy. You go, why? Ephesians 5:32. Well, this mystery is great, Paul says. But I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. So when you have a man who leads this way, it's a picture of Jesus as the bridegroom. So let me ask you a question. Does Jesus lead unconditionally? Yeah, that's Romans 5. Does Jesus lead sacrificially? Yeah, he died for us. Does he lead purifyingly? Does he lead selflessly and intimately? And my prayer is that I will be a man who will love and serve and nurture and cherish and lay down my life for my wife. And I want to do it in such a way that others will see Christ in our marriage. And I can tell you this, beyond a shadow of a doubt, if you want to reach people for Christ, your greatest evangelistic tool that you have is your marriage. Because that's what pictures Christ and his bride. Listen, you may be able to clearly articulate the gospel. You may be able to work through the Romans Road or the four spiritual laws or any of those things. You may be able to identify all of those things so well, articulate it and everything else. But if your marriage doesn't show that, you're not going to have the impact that you could have. Your marriage is the greatest apologetic for what Christ did for his bride. And the most attractive and respectable man is one who will protect and provide and love and serve and nurture and nourish and cherish his wife. That's respectful. That's attractive. So let's get real practical then. Number one, lead in prioritizing your wife and family. Okay, lead in prioritizing your wife and family. What does that look like? Well, first, plan time together with your wife. Plan it. We just use a Google Calendar for our family, and everybody just puts their stuff on there, and so we just look up, you know, is there anything going on that day, and so we're able to know all of these things, so we're able to plan these times together. Okay, plan it, don't wing it. The next one, leave work early or cancel an appointment to be with your family. Just don't do this every day. You're going to get fired if you do it every day. Okay, but how many times do you cancel something with your family because you have something at work? Right? Switch that around. Eat dinner together as a family. And when I say that, I don't say, you know, driving through McDonald's and, okay, we're all going to pray, and you get to the stoplight and you pray together. I'm not talking about that dinner together as a family. I'm saying at a table, a real physical table that doesn't have a sewing machine on it, doesn't have books on it, a table that you sit down together as a family and eat dinner together. No cell phones, no iPads. You just sit and you eat together. And by the way, don't use that time to bring up those tough conversations that you've always wanted to talk about. But don't use that time to bash your kids. Don't use that time to be an I told you so time. Listen well, eat together, laugh a lot. There's other times for those conversations. Protect that dinner table. Eat dinner together as a family. Do the little thing, confess quickly and forgive completely. We're gonna deal with that in our last session of what that looks like. But do the little things so that she knows she matters. Those little things so she knows she matters. So you can read the list, pray together, read the Bible together, do the little jobs you said you'd do. I'll say that again. Do the little jobs you said you'd do. Go for walks. Take time just to talk. One of the things my wife used to love, we don't have to do it anymore because our kids are old enough, but get the babysitter and don't make her do it. Decide where to eat. Call without needing anything. Make the difficult decisions. And women, you can say amen to this. When both of you are home, the husband should be the one doing the discipline. That's what it means to lead. When both of you are home, the husband is the one who's doing the discipline. And so I would ask you, is there a man in your home? Is there somebody who has put off childish things? Is there somebody who is willing to take the moral responsibility to lovingly lead his family? Husbands, love your wives. I want to end with this story. My mom was 14 when her and my dad got married. 14 years, and she had just turned 14 2 weeks before that. He was 27. That's illegal now. So for his whole life, he has this young, beautiful bride that he thought would outlive him. My mom passed away in 2005 after a five-year illness. And these 5 years, she went from this very independent, beautiful woman who was somebody who was totally dependent on my dad. 18 times every day, my dad had in his routine where he would pick her up. He would move her so she wouldn't have to just stay in bed. He'd put her in a wheelchair and take her for walks. He had to do all the cooking. He had to do all the cleaning. He had to bathe her and feed her and dress her and wipe her. And she went from a beautiful young bride to a bald-headed woman with scars from brain surgery. And he loved her in sickness and in health, and in good times and in bad, and for better and for worse. And my dad wasn't a Christian. How much more should we, as followers of Christ, model this? And I am embarrassed to say that we have guys who would rather play a video game than spend time with their wives. And it's the little things that we would do as husbands when our wives are younger that will give our wives security and knowledge of knowing that she has a husband who will care for her as long as she lives. And you know the argument, well, no, you're going to die, or I'm going to die first, or, you know, that's always the argument, is like one of us wants to die first. And I've said publicly, I hope Sherry dies before I do. I want her to die before me because I want to take care of her until the day she dies. I don't want somebody else to have to do that. Now, we have a lot of disagreement, I would say, on leading, and I hope I've given a biblical picture of this. But let me just close with these five principles here of what leading does not mean. Okay, what leading does not mean. Number one, you always do what your wife wants. That's the passive pleaser, right? You don't give your wife everything she wants. Leading well means you give her everything she needs. And sometimes, you know what? Your wife needs risks. She needs to accomplish things on her own. She needs to trust God and not always have to turn to you. Number two, leading does not mean that you don't have a life. Men, you need time with men. You need to hang out with men and work out with men. And there's got to be time with other men, and that's okay. Listening to Roy earlier talk about fishing. Man, I love going fishing with Roy. And waves are usually too high for us to be able to do it, but whenever we can get out there, we do. Why? Because we need time together. We have this great Bible study, men's Bible study. We just love the men that gather. And if you go, well, then I'm not going to have a life. You'll have a life, right? Even if you make time with your family. It's just a matter of priorities. And you go, well, who's doing this? Look for somebody who's doing it, and then just ask them to mentor you. And don't tell them you need a Bible study and meet every week or anything. Just observe them. You know, invite them over for dinner. Watch how he treats his wife. And the things that used to be common sense, listen, they're just not common anymore. Number three, it doesn't mean that you make her dependent on you. You don't smother your wife. Number four, it doesn't mean that you call all the shots. That's the arrogant dictator. Love your wives like Christ loved the church. And then number five, the last one, you control your wife. And we're going to deal with that in the next session at length about abuse and what it looks like to lead. All right, I am right on time. Looky there. So let's take 10 minutes, and then we'll meet back in here at 9:45 for the role of wives.